Good evening all. I'd like to begin by acknowledging some people in the room. The Honourable Dr. Lynn Arnold, Chair of Trustees of Don Dunstan Foundation, Professor Luigi O'Donoghue, after whom the oration is named, and Mr. Ray Martin, tonight's orator. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the 2010 Don Dunstan Foundation Luigi O'Donoghue Oration. My name is Darryl Rigney. I'm an Associate Professor at the Yungerendi First Nations Centre for Higher Education and Research at Flinders University, and I have the pleasure of being your MC for at least part of tonight's proceedings. The Don Dunstan Foundation was established in 1999 and honours the legacy of Don Dunstan and reflects his life's work through the fostering of research, education, discussion and action on key public policy issues. Flinders University and the University of Adelaide, as key supporters of the Don Dunstan Foundation, take seriously the Foundation's objectives of promoting visionary and progressive leadership and thinking within government and private sector in South Australia, as well as working towards outcomes for a fairer, progressive, just and more tolerant society. At this point in proceedings, I'd like to call upon Mr. Jack Buckskin, if he's in the room, as a representative of the Kaurna Nation, to officially open proceedings by giving a welcome to country. If Jack's not in the room, and I believe that may be the case, then that honour will fall to myself, because I can claim along my father's mother's side Kaurna. And so, in the absence of Jack, on behalf of the Kaurna Nation, I want to acknowledge that we actually are on Kaurna country, Kaurna Yerta, the traditional owners of the country on which we meet. I want to acknowledge the leadership, knowledge and wisdom of Kaurna culture and its people. I want to acknowledge your responsibility to care for country and all it represents, and as an expression of respect, view such acknowledgement as an essential cultural protocol. Thank you for allowing us to spend the evening in Kaurna Yerta. Okay. At this point, I would like to introduce the Honourable Dr. Lynn Arnold, Chair of Trustees of the Don Dunstan Foundation, to introduce tonight's speaker, Mr. Ray Martin.
Nainamane, Natadlu Tawila Bukiana Mayuna Tampendi, Ngadlu Gana Yatanga Inbarendi. We want to recognise the spirits of the ancestors of the Kaurna Nation, elders past, elders present and elders to come. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome you to the 2010 Luigi O'Donoghue Oration, and particularly of course want to acknowledge the presence here tonight of Professor Luigi O'Donoghue. And if you want to also have a presence of hers in another way, you can buy the very first lecture that she gave in 2007 outside the front. Can I also acknowledge, we have had here at the reception before, but they were unable to stay, the Honourable Grace Portalisi, Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, and Isabel Redman, Leader of the Opposition. And of course we had His Excellency Rear Admiral Kevin Scarce here as well. Here we also have Francis Bedford and Stephen Marshall from the House of Assembly. The Don Dunstan Foundation is a partnership with Flinders University and the University of Adelaide, and I acknowledge Professor Andrew Parkin representing the Vice-Chancellor of Flinders University and Professor Birgit Lohmann representing the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Adelaide. Reconciliation South Australian chairs, co-chairs, Professor Peter Buckskin and Jan Chorley, and my fellow Reconciliation Ambassador for South Australia, Shirley Peasley, to Greg Crafter and Ray. Greg is the former Chair of the Trustees of the Don Dunstan Foundation, and Bill Cossey, the Chair of the Board of Management. Of course, especially to Ray Martin, who I'll be introducing shortly as our guest speaker, as our orator for this 2010 Luigi O'Donoghue Oration, Walking Together on a Journey of Healing. And to distinguished guests all, it is a great pleasure to have you here with us tonight. I have acknowledged some apologies already. I want to acknowledge some more. The Premier, Mike Rann, is overseas and sends his apologies accordingly. Bronwyn Don't, Don Dunstan's daughter, asked for her apologies to be recorded, as did the Vice-Chancellors James McGuire and Michael Barber, both from Flinders and from Adelaide. my note here says that Michael Barber's overseas. Well, I was with him at lunchtime today, but anyway, so. The Philip Adams, who was on the first board of trustees of the Don Dunstan Foundation, sends his apologies, and he particularly asked Luisa that I convey his love to you. He wanted that to be recorded. Minister Tom Koutsantonis is an apology, as is Professor Peter Hoy, Vice-Chancellor of the University of South Australia, and Commissioner Clinton Wanganeen, Mr. Terry Stevens, and also Chris Eccles, Chief Executive of the Department of Premier and Cabinet. Now, we are to hear, once again, an oration. It's about a narrative of reconciliation, because the community narrative contains winds within it that need changing. And reconciliation is a process of acknowledging that we all have to be in this together. Reconciliation this week, in fact, has had the theme of walking together on the journey of healing. On the occasion of the first anniversary of the national apology by the Prime Minister, on the first anniversary of that, here in South Australia, Lillian Holt gave the lecture. And on that occasion, she spoke about the need for attitudinal healing and spoke about that being a need for all of us within the community. I am not the orator tonight, and so don't want to go on at great length. But I do want to read three pieces from members of our community, past and present, two present, one past. First of all, Captain Jack, a Kaurna elder in the 1840s, spoke in the Kaurna language and was translated by G.C. Teichelman and C.W. Sherman in their Outlines of a Grammar Vocabulary for South Australia. Wrote this, formerly we lived here for some time, otherwhere we will now live. Here I feel now anxious for another district. In that gentle way of talking about formerly we lived here for some time, of course we were talking about a period of 40,000 years. And this was in a colony where there had been a promise made that there would be due regard paid to the original settlers, to the original inhabitants of this community. A document long since lost to the public memory has, of course, come to light in recent times, the letters patent, which called for that recognition to be done. And yet that was how Captain Jack would speak in the 1840s. One would have thought things might have changed over time, because this, of course, is a state of great promise, of great aspirations. And yet it would be Uncle Lewis Yulaburka O'Brien, in his book And the Clock Struck 13, who wrote this. There is this myth that says South Australia was different to the other states in Australia and was settled in an orderly manner. But I think by telling my own family story, I have demonstrated that that was not the case. We Aboriginal people were pushed off our land, particularly in the urban areas, just as they were in other states. But now I think it is time to celebrate the fact that South Australians are coming together in different ways to reconcile our past and to share this country of ours. What I have written here, he speaks about his book, is about what I know and what I've been told. Now that I've finished telling my story, I get a certain sense of pride from what I've written and a great deal of satisfaction from what I've achieved. And another voice from the present, Doris Cartinieri from the Can. She wrote, I'm a 54-year-old Narangeri Mimini. I am proud to be Nunga. The battles and struggles of living in two worlds that I enjoyed throughout my life have proven my Aboriginality. I am Doris. I have learned to love myself. I love myself. I walk with dignity. I had lived in silence for many years. I now have the confidence to express my feelings and to speak openly. In both those situations, we have a current narrative that speaks of pain, but also speaks of a new journey in reconciliation. And it is precisely for that that the Don Dunstan Foundation inaugurated the Luisa O'Donoghue Oration in 2007, but also as part of the aim aims of this organization, of this foundation, to promote a change of direction of community narratives. The late Premier, the Honourable Don Dunstan, was one of the great social reforming premiers of Australian history, one could say the greatest, and he would be proud of the spirit at tonight's event. Many are not aware anymore because they have forgotten it or may never have known it, that Don Dunstan and his government introduced Australia's first Land Rights Act legislation, the Aboriginal Lands Trust Act, in 1966. That was before the 1967 referendum. Grace Portalesi, the Minister, has noted that it is significant that this legislation was so well crafted that it stood the test of time so well that it is only now, some 44 years later, that it is coming under review. Many of you will know that the theme of Aboriginal reconciliation is one of the six main foci of the Don Dunstan Foundation, all of which represent the key values that were contributed to by Don Dunstan through his life and work. All six of the Foundation's values relate to aspects of social justice and human rights. The focus tonight on Aboriginal reconciliation reminds us that we have both a personal obligation and a shared obligation to do what we can to empower everyone in our society. We must have a genuine intent to remove the multiple disadvantages, for example, faced by the Aboriginal population in our community. The Don Dunstan Foundation has chosen to make a major focus of Aboriginal employment, and we have identified an area where we believe there is great opportunity for meaningful careers for Aboriginal people, and we're doing what we can to make that happen with and not for Aboriginal people, in the very spirit of the way Don Dunstan himself worked. The Don Dunstan Foundation is a not-for-profit charity, and if you'd like to support the work of the Foundation, there is a strategic plan booklet available at the door that you can have a look at, and we encourage you to do so, because that lays out the plan for the years ahead. But ladies and gentlemen, that can be your homework after you've left. For now, we are here with great pleasure to hear our orator. So I return to the focus of reconciliation and would like to warmly welcome Ray Martin to present tonight's Luitra O'Donoghue oration. Ray himself needs no introduction. He is well known to all of us for his work through the media, but also for his work in commentary in this country. What is possibly less well known is Ray's long-standing commitment to Aboriginal reconciliation. Ray was active in the area long before many in our community had formulated positions. He spent a decade as the chair of the Fred Hollows Foundation, and he is in his third term of appointment to the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation. Ray is also deeply involved in a variety of other charities, particularly those related to children's health. Amongst these other charities, Ray is patron of the Humpty Dumpty Foundation, which raises medical equipment, funds for medical equipment for children's hospitals across the country. Ray Martin epitomises the point that reconciliation is a personal responsibility, not just a government responsibility, and not just Aboriginal people's responsibility. It is all of our responsibility. Ray is showing us how together and separately we must find ways to make this happen. Ray, as one who cares deeply for Aboriginal reconciliation, it is my pleasure to welcome you tonight and to invite you to deliver the 2010 Luitra O'Donoghue Oration.
Thank you, Lynn, so much indeed. I'll give myself some water. Oration, it's not a word I normally associate myself with. I just said the lower chap, I'm orator. She was impressed. Thank you, Dr. Arnold. That was for that warm welcome and your introduction. I thank both universities as well for their support of tonight and hosting tonight. We thank you so much. Thank you, Lower Chair, as always. I thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out. Nothing on television tonight, nothing worth missing. I also acknowledge the traditional owners, the Kaurna peoples, and I pay my deep respects to their elders, along with their ancestors and with their Dreamtime stories and their culture. Walking together on the journey of healing. That's the topic of this fourth Luitra O'Donoghue Oration for the Don Dunstan Foundation. I have to say that I'm deeply honoured to be here with you tonight. Don Dunstan was an old, treasured friend of mine, whom I admired, as did everybody who met him. I got to interview Don many times over the years, both for the ABC and for Channel 9. And I can't tell you the number of times that that I'd come to Adelaide to do a story for 60 Minutes or for A Current Affair in the later years. We'd catch the last plane in from Sydney, and we'd go straight to the Norwood restaurant that Don had with Steve and his partner. And there we'd get to share some of his latest favourite cheeses and wines and sometimes a dessert from Stephen. Always the best South Australian, of course. I'd also seek some wise words or some inspiration, which Don gave freely every time he opened his mouth. I fell into Lowitz's circle of wisdom more than 20 years ago, when she was the chairperson of ATSIC and was also deputy chair of the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation, of which I was a member for 10 rollicking years. As the council held its sessions around the country, as we did for those years, I was appointed by Bob Hawke and then reappointed by John Howard for 2 terms. As we went around the country, I would always try and stay in Lowitz's slipstream, close at hand, in the bus, at dinner, at any community meetings, anywhere at all. Because long ago I learned that if you stand next to someone who's compassionate and wise and smart, and you just nod a lot, that people, some may think you know what you're talking about, you get away with anything. So that's why I stuck with her. So working together on the journey of healing, that's what I want you to think about tonight. It's called an oration, as I said earlier, but I'm a storyteller, I'm a journalist, that's pretty much what journalists are, they're storytellers. So I'm going to tell you some stories tonight about some of my experiences over the last 45 years. I hope that, like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, that they'll all come together in a bigger picture of walking together on the journey of healing. Of course, to visualise where we're going on this journey, we must always have a glimpse in the rear vision mirror to see where we've been, and I'll be brief. As Anton Chekhov, the great Russian dramatist, once said, to begin to live in the present, we must always atone for our past and be finished with it. Atone for our past. My delivery was the American poet Carl Sandburg, who wrote that the past is just a bucket of ashes. Either way, I must say that I was thinking on the flight across here today from Sydney that the Don Dunstan Institute could not have chosen this topic during the John Howard era, because the Howard era was not a journey of healing. Now, I don't want to get into party politics tonight, but it simply wasn't that sort of a journey. If you think about those 11 years, it was a time when an apology was categorically rejected. It was a time when government ministers almost choked at the thought of acknowledging the traditional owners of this great land. When the Bring Them Home report was summarily dismissed, and the victims of the Stolen Generation policies were insulted inside the courtrooms by government lawyers. When ATSIC was allowed to almost self-implode. When Pauline Hanson was allowed to speak her divisive ramblings and go unchallenged by the federal government. And finally, for some mysterious reason, in the last weeks of the 2007 federal election, the army intervened in the Northern Territory. Now, I happen to believe that that was a justifiable intervention, but it was too late and it was too heavy-handed, it was misdirected, and I think it was mismanaged. 10 years ago last Friday, with Lowitz and others, I walked across the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Maybe there were some people here who walked across on that occasion 10 years ago. Now, one of the reasons that walk at Happy Marks, that political event, was so successful was that it was a genuine people's movement, as we'd never seen in Australia before. It was a special walk for me because I'd been given the task as a member of the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation of organising that grand symbolic walk, bridging black and white Australians. That was my job for the best part of a year in setting that up. Still stepping forward 10 years to tonight, I believe that that historic walk across the bridge in Sydney, with almost, about 300,000, mostly white fellas, was almost as monumental, as momentous, as the 1967 referendum, symbolically. Obviously, the bridge walk didn't change the constitution or the legal status of Aboriginal people, but it marked the climax of 10 years of good work by the Reconciliation Council, and it started to change some attitudes. And I think that's important, obviously, to change attitudes. In some cases, it tackled entrenched racist attitudes in Australia. The Reconciliation Councils, like the state, the South Australian Council here, certainly made Australians think again about what a fair go really means where our Indigenous people are concerned. Over the last few days, there have been some reviews and public comments on radio and television, certainly in Sydney, that suggested that the Bridge War kickstart this new era that we're talking about tonight, a new beginning which now embraces big business and banks and mining conglomerates and sporting organisations and the best high schools in the country and the schools, all beyond government. It embraces ordinary Australians, especially school kids and young people in Australia, and that's obviously very important. For Indigenous Australians, it may still be, as someone suggested to me earlier tonight, it may still be a journey of hurting. I certainly hope not. Kevin Rudd's deeply moving apology on February the 13th, 2007, was not just long overdue, it was also a necessary step in our healing process. It had to happen before we could start the healing journey. I read a newsletter the other day about that February speech that Mr. Rudd gave. It's a book called Encounter, The Past and Future of Remote Kimberley. It's a fascinating local WA history that was sent to me by its author, Sister Brigida Nalan. The newsletter was written, it's in the book, was written by one Father Ray Haverne, like Heaven Haverne. He's the regional leader of the Catholic Order, the Palatines, which has been based in WA for over a century. And Father Haverne wrote quite poignantly about standing alone in the crowd on the Perth Esplanade, watching Mr. Rudd speak from Canberra on the giant screen that was up there on the lawn. It was a little after 7 a.m. in Perth, the father reminds us. And the priest spoke of, quote, the crowd near him quietly crying. And he goes on to say this. He said, I felt glad that I belonged in a country that was no longer in denial, but whose populace as a whole could admit the immeasurable harm that had been done. And respectfully, still his quote, respectfully and graciously apologised to the Aboriginal people who were sitting in front of him. Now, we've come a long way, but it's taken a damn long time. In my journalism career, I've interviewed every Prime Minister since Sir Robert Menzies, back in the 60s. I don't know, but I think history may well decide that Malcolm Fraser was arguably the most proactive of our PMs when it came to the push for Indigenous rights. Mr. Fraser was horrified by the assimilation policies of the past. He favoured land rights. He personally had no trouble with the idea of a treaty as he pushed his reluctant cabinet to accept the idea of a Makarrata. Malcolm Fraser believed in the right of self-determination. He also doubled the federal money spent on Aboriginal affairs. Now, they're all things that I think Don Dunstan would have nodded and approved of. And this is Malcolm Fraser we're talking about. It's no wonder he felt lost in John Howard's Liberal Party. Mr. Fraser set up the Aboriginal Development Commission with Charlie Perkins as its boss, which of course sparked, amongst other initiatives, the CDEP. We can all probably remember, if you're old enough, those photos of Big Mal sitting in the empty Todd River, larger, in his tweed suit. There he was in his tweed suit, talking to ordinary blackfellas for about an hour or so up there, just asking questions and talking. And the time he went fishing, again there was a photograph in a tinny of Galaroy Napingu, wearing a safari suit, God forbid, and a slouch hat, but holding up a barra as big as his arm. At the time in the late 1970s, in the early 80s, Fraser's policies were radical, especially for the Liberal and National Country parties in Australia. Yet in his memoirs, which were just published this year in April, the former Prime Minister speaks of being ashamed of the suffering and of the inequalities, the lack of human rights for Indigenous Australians. He says, I think we were too timid. We didn't go nearly far enough, he says. And he even suggests that his government should have instituted a policy of positive discrimination to ensure that Aboriginal jobs were given in the Commonwealth Public Service. Positive discrimination. And he says, quote, "How else are you going to get a change? We should probably have gone ahead," he said, "and done it. And today there might be a difference as a result," unquote. Well, we'll never know. Of course, he didn't do it. Still, such impassioned statements, public apologies, if you like, from former prime ministers undoubtedly help in our healing process. So let me offer a brief final quote from Malcolm Fraser again, from his latest political memoirs. And what he says is really pertinent to where we are today. The book's co-author, journalist Margaret Simon, writes about a speech that Mr. Fraser researched and delivered sometime in the 1990s. Let me read it to you. She says he, Mr. Fraser, quoted health experts who said that an extra $300 million per year, $300 million per year, in Aboriginal health would increase life expectancy by 30% within a decade. And he says neither Labor nor the Coalition was prepared to commit those resources. And he says the notion that more was spent on Aboriginal health than on the health of other Australians was a complete fiction. And this is the line. The idea that there is something uniquely intractable about despair and dysfunction in Aboriginal Australia was wrong and implicitly racist. Let me tell you again. The idea that there is something uniquely intractable about despair and dysfunction in Aboriginal Australia was wrong and implicitly racist. How often do we hear that saying, well, it's a problem we can't fix? Wrong and implicitly racist. It's commendable stuff, which I have no doubt he honestly believed and believes today. The only trouble is that Malcolm Fraser, like so many of our well-intentioned political leaders, seems to acquire this wisdom and the solutions after he left office, after he lost the power to change things. It's the wisdom of hindsight, once again, that we find from our leaders so often. And I find it remarkable. Wait till you see. It sounds like a knock against John Howard. I don't mean that at all, but let's wait and see what Howard's memoirs say at the end of this year. But it's remarkable how many of our former national leaders single out Aboriginal affairs as their great regret, the thing that they wish they'd have done better. Well, brother, they had the chance, and they didn't. Now, I wasn't going to even mention Indigenous health tonight, apart from that reference that Malcolm Fraser had. I figure we all know how outrageously bad and how shameful it is. Still, it's the horrific detail that sometimes takes your breath away, that may yet force governments to fix it in this time of healing. I don't know whether you saw it, but there was a medical report in last weekend's Australian newspaper. It was a new study of diabetes in Western Australia. In that article, we learned that Indigenous Australians are 7 times more likely to suffer from diabetes. Now, that's not surprising. It rolls off the tongue easily, 7 times more likely to suffer from diabetes. We shake our heads in the certain knowledge that it's always been bad. The knowledge that, for whatever reason, Indigenous peoples seem to be predisposed to getting diabetes. In Australia, in the Pacific Islands, in lots of places. For some reason, they get diabetes. And then you move on to the article, to the gory details. My wife, I have to say, didn't want me to read them aloud to her on Saturday morning when I was reading this article. But we must read them. We must go to the details. This new report says that these people, Indigenous people in West Australia, in the age group 25 to 49, so the second half, the back half of their lives, 25 to 49, these Indigenous men and women are 27 times more likely to have their toes or their feet amputated than white fellas. 27 times more likely to have their feet or their toes chopped off. And, wait for it, 38 times more likely to receive major leg amputations above or below the knee. 38 times. If that isn't reprehensible and disgusting enough, the new report says that 5 years after this amputation, because of diabetes, remember, 5 years after, half those same people are either dead or need the other leg amputated 5 years later. Now, to say that Indigenous people get diabetes 7 times more than other white fellas doesn't tell the story. It doesn't tell us enough. Visit an Aboriginal camp or settlement and see just how many people wander around there or sitting on a veranda who don't have their feet, who've had their feet and their legs amputated. Now imagine for one moment if it was happening in White Australia, in Adelaide. Imagine how quickly the problem would be solved. We say it every time, don't we? But I hadn't seen such a stark, terrible figure in a long time. Now we must tell these shocking stories, and then we've got to tell them again, and we tell them again. To ordinary Australians. We tell them at barbecues, it's fairly not the sort of thing you normally talk about when you're having a feed, but at barbecues and dinner tables and at public meetings. Because I think it's truly part of the healing process. Not to say seven times, but to go into that terrible detail. And I believe we must especially tell these stories to women, and we must tell it to our mothers. Early on in the work that we did in the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation, we deliberately aimed our messages at Australian women. Through the Women's Weekly, through the Glossy magazine, through the Country Women's Association, through clubs and through school PNCs. Unashamedly and anecdotally, I think it worked. Because women are ultimately the ones in our society who finally decide our attitudes and our morality. We've got lots of male politicians, but women, our mothers especially, decide that. They set the parameters of what's decent and what's acceptable, and conversely, what's indecent and what is unacceptable. I tell Lowitura O'Donoghue's story, her own story, to women, and to women's groups often, probably more than she ever does these days, with a reason. Because Lowitura comes across to Australians on television and in life as an intelligent, caring, compassionate, capable, well-educated role model. Not just for black women, but for white women as well. Of course, she has all those qualities I mentioned, and she's got much more than that. But then I tell them about how she and her sister brother were taken away as babes and toddlers down here to Adelaide, and her work here as a domestic and then as a nurse, and how some 30-odd years later, she ended up at the Unidata Base Hospital as the senior nurse. 30 years later. Am I getting it right, Artie? Am I roughly there? Roughly, okay. And how she arrived at the Unidata Airport one Saturday afternoon. A couple of local Aboriginal women recognised her. They were sitting in the dirt, and they recognised her as the daughter of Mary or Agnes or whatever mum's white name was. And a couple of weeks later, her mother walked through the hospital door and fell into Lowitura's arms and cried a bucket of tears. Her mother spoke no English, but she pined for her stolen daughter and for her children after 30 years. Now, I think that's a much better human story, a real story, than saying that 10,000 Aboriginal boys and girls made up the stolen generation, that 10,000 were taken away. White women and mothers understand that kind of trauma and that kind of heartache, what it must have been like, even though they may never have known it themselves. They understand. I've got to tell you, Lowitura first told me that story about 20 years ago in a restaurant just across the road here in Adelaide, but only after I asked about her background. And then I remember later that night she left her colleagues from the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation. We're all sitting down having a meal. And she went down to the Adelaide train station in a cotton frock without a coat or a cardigan in the cold, I remember. And like a Kelpie sheepdog, she was rounding up the Aboriginal kids who were hanging around the station, kids who were waiting to get into trouble. She barked at them and she herded them onto their trains to at least get them out of the clutches of the city predators. Now, Lowitura O'Donoghue was the boss of ATSIC at the time. She was one of the most senior public servants in Australia. But caring and healing is in her blood. I don't think she knows how to stop. Thank God she doesn't. There are two quick stories in this, I mentioned stories, and I think stories that I like to tell on my journey. I think it's part of my healing process when I talk to people. I'll be quick. 43 years ago, when I first got graded as a journalist, I was dispatched to the ABC's Perth Bureau. On one radio assignment, I ended up in Meekatharra, at the end of the railway line. Now let me point out, this was 1967, just weeks before the famous 67 referendum. But Meekatharra in WA was an apartheid town, segregated, divided, racist, South Africa in the Australian outback. Well, I got talking to an old Aboriginal man who'd been physically thrown out of the white fella's only pub in the main street. I say old, but he was probably only about 55. He seemed ancient to me at the time I was a kid. He told me about being arrested as a child, as a little boy, outside of the Pilbara town of Roebourne. I did a radio interview with him. He said it was the year the first T-model Ford arrived in town. He recalled that with a bit of a laugh. And he laughed a lot as he told me stories of his life. Although he reckoned he was only about 10, He was arrested as a suspect in the spearing of two cattle, he told me. And he told the police which blackfellas he thought had done the dirty deed. But before they headed off, they chained him to a baobab tree in the hot tropical sun. He was 10. And they left him with a pannikin of water, he said, which he accidentally knocked over the first day. And he said it was 3 days before the coppers returned with the guilty culprits. And they set him free. Again, he was only 10. Now, there was no angst, there was no bitterness, he just thought and knew that's what whites did to blacks. That was life. 40-odd years later, here he was in Meekatharra, and they'd thrown him out of the pub. Not because he was a drunk, but because of the colour of his skin. He wasn't upset, but I was. I was very angry. I couldn't believe that such racist, outrageous things could happen in my country. Mind you, in the years ahead, as I travelled around the place, I heard and saw things that were much, much worse than that. And the final story I want to tell you happened in the late 1990s. And again, I tell these a bit like the details of the diabetes that I just told you a moment ago. Bryce Courtney, the best-selling author, asked me to launch his latest novel at the time, which was a book called Jessica, that people may have read here. Set in the prosperous Riverina town of Narandra, it tells the story of a white woman who goes mad, and she's saved by the local Aboriginal people. Basically the plot. Now after the book launch, a lady who happened to be the Narandra public librarian told me of an incident that had happened to her about a year earlier. She was about 35, mid-30s. It was NAIDOC week, so in the library foyer she had posted up on the walls around there a number of old black and white photographs of the local Wiradjuri people. They'd been taken in the 1930s, these photographs. And while she stamped the books for this old man who'd borrowed a local man she knew who was borrowing the books, she was intrigued to see him shaking his head as he looked at the photographs. And she asked him why he was shaking his head. He explained that one Sunday morning as a six-year-old boy, he was a white fellow, as a six-year-old boy, his father had taken him down to an island in the Murrumbidgee River nearby with a shooting party. That they were going out to shoot some blacks, his father said. And they did. They certainly fired some shots, he said. He doesn't know where they shot them, but he certainly fired some shots. Now, what shocked this man was not only that they had shot at innocent people, women and old people, but that his father had taken him along, as if shooting blacks was part of his transition to manhood, as if it was part of his culture. The librarian figured, given the old man's age at the time, we talked about it, she said he must have been talking about Narandra in New South Wales in the 1930s. Not the 1830s, the 1930s. I tell these stories and many others to remind white Australians, to inform them, if you like, of life as it really is and has been for black Australians for the past 200 years. Beyond the colonial massacres and the poisoned water holes and the contagious diseases and the forced separation of families, all the stuff that we've read about and we think we know about. Before white fellas like Pauline Hanson start talking absurdly about special privileges for black fellas and payouts and ab study and free buses and lunches for black kids. I remind them of the reality, the stigmata, the racist attacks on Indigenous Australians just because they're black or even mildly brown. Where my mum lived in Gunnedah in New South Wales, I remember in the 60s going there to the swimming pool at Gunnedah and the lifeguard would hose black kids down before they were allowed to go in the pool. We didn't get hosed. They got hosed down before they were allowed to go in the pool, and I could never understand why. And I say all these things before I tell them rather proudly that my great-great-grandmother was a Kamilaroi woman from Keepit Station in northern New South Wales. When I tell them that usually slows them down a bit. Stories like that are always better than making white Australians feel guilty. Or all those poor bugger me stories that we hear from blackfellas. Indeed, I like to tell white Australians how leaders like Lowitcher and Noel Pearson and Sally Perkins when he was around used to harangue and harass and tongue-lash blackfellas for not picking up their garbage and for not sending their kids to school and for not getting off their black asses and getting a job and for living off welfare and for not setting an example to their children. I've seen Lowitcher do it. Now, these are powerful messages, more powerful when they come from black leaders and they resonate amongst whites. Remember, in this healing process, we don't have to win over the blackfellas. We have to win over the white fellas. the 98% of the population. They're the ones that that truly have to be reconciled. Now let me underline this because it's a bit like a marketing strategy, if you like. It's clearly time for a change, I think, in the message that's been sent out to White Australia. This is a two-way street we live in now. Indigenous leaders have to get much smarter in bringing about changes and in capitalising on what I think is a positive mood in this healing process that we're here to talk about tonight. The days of endlessly bashing up white fellas for being racist and insensitive and not caring are over. They're gone. That knee-jerk reaction is clearly out of step, I think, with modern multicultural Australia. That's not to deny for a second that racism still exists, especially in regional Australia. It certainly does. We have to be vigilant and we have to stamp it out. But it's no good trying to make Australians take the blame, white Australians, for policies that go back 50 or 100 years and for attitudes. And it's too late for blackfella excuses. Clearly, blackfellas have to show strong new leadership, more than ever before. And they've got to get fair dinkum about the raging problems in their communities. The new leaders have to start taking responsibility for the chronic and the widespread abuse and the violence. No excuses, and they've got to stop denying that it exists. Denying gives them no credibility at all, because it does exist, and we know it. Parents and community leaders must get kids to school. No excuses. Men have to get off welfare and booze and ganja. No excuses. And get into jobs that are available and stick with them. Young Indigenous men have to be encouraged to take up training for the countless jobs, certainly the mining industry, that need special skills and that need them today. No more excuses. And if we're talking honestly, it's time for a bit of honesty about all the tens of billions of taxpayers' dollars that have gone into Aboriginal affairs over the last decade or so, without any real sign of improvement. Money that's clearly been wasted by governments or by somebody. It's a question I get asked all the time. What about all this money that we spend? What about all the taxpayers' money? And it makes me smile. Because that's the same question that I asked Charlie Perkins 25 years ago when he came on Midday, when I was doing the Midday show. I said, what happens to the $1 billion a year, Charlie, that goes into the so-called Aboriginal affairs? Charlie threw his head back and he laughed. And he said that he bloody wished he knew what had happened to it. He said, I don't have any of it. Well, today taxpayers have slugged over $2 billion a year to help close the gap of disadvantage, the gap we have to close. It's still the same answer. Nobody can properly explain where all this money ends up. Now, one thing's for certain, there aren't any blackfellas living with George Clooney in Switzerland. No blackfellas sitting on sunny Spanish tax havens like Christopher Scales did for a while. You may remember in the Oscar-winning movie All the President's Men, Robert Redford's character, Bob Woodward, of the Washington Post. And he asks Deep Throat, down in the darkness of the car park, he says, how do we get to the bottom of the Watergate puzzle? And Deep Throat tells him obliquely, follow the money. Follow the money. Well, if you somehow follow the Aboriginal money trail, you'll quickly find that it bypasses the shanty towns and the camp dogs and the diabetes row to white consultants and white contractors and white public servants. It ends up in the deep pockets of the Aboriginal industry. That's where it ends up. And these days I tell people about the 90 very nice but very basic houses for blackfellas that I saw being built up in the Tiwi Islands last weekend. They cost almost $1 million apiece. Almost $1 million each, paid for by Australian taxpayers. And I met a couple of white workers, true story, on the housing projects, good, hard-working blokes, good blokes, who've passed up fishing this season down at Port Lincoln because there's much more money to be made contracting houses for blackfellas up in the Tiwi Islands. I tell people that while 2,000 Indigenous folks sit around the Tiwi Islands in the shade with nothing to do, with no jobs, there's not one young blackfella tradesman being trained by the government for when the contractors go back home. No apprentices being trained, even though they're up there for about 18 months. So your guess is as good as mine as to what happens when the toilets break or the electricity fails or a few tiles come off the floor, as they do in every new house. who's left to fix them? And what shape are these million-dollar houses going to be in 10 years' time, if there are no local tradesmen to look after them? Again, your guess is as good as mine. I've been to places with literature, and we know what happens. They get trashed. Now, I spent a lot of time talking tonight about the failure of governments in walking together on the journey of healing. I want to finally spend a moment talking about a couple of the real success stories, I think, on this journey. There are a growing number of them. That's why I think the time is ripe. Some are small and more symbolic, seemingly trivial, but I don't think they are. Some are large and groundbreaking and very exciting. All are contributing to, I think, greater tolerance and greater understanding, all part of the healing process. For example, still up in Bathurst and Melville Island, in those Tiwi Islands just off Darwin, I saw some fantastic things being done by the Australian Football League, by the AFL. I think their work in Indigenous communities, respecting families, culture and tradition, and I'm a rugby league bloke, I think their work is easily the most enlightened and the most professional of any sports in Australia. Easily. But if you think this is just about football, well, think again. This is about life, and it's about dreams for blackfellas and for young blackfellas. Remember, it wasn't so long ago that black Aussie rule players like Nicky Winmar and Michael Long were pulling up their club jerseys and pointing at their black skin. It was their way of responding to ugly racist taunts from white crowds and even from other players. Racism, as we know, is rampant in Australian sport, and especially football. Well, that's now stopped. That's a big part of the healing process. Today, as part of the AFL's genuine role in the healing process, they pump huge piles of money into coaching Indigenous kids, offering alternate lifestyle to booze, into drugs, into indolence. They organise interstate excursions, and they promote tournaments, while they deploy squads of senior players to work with Indigenous kids, both boys and girls. And they do it by the thousands. And it's not only about fighting the next fleet-footed, high-flying black superstar. I'm sure they'd love that. It's certainly not about teaching kids to kick with both left and right foot either. Nobody has to teach them. They do that automatically, almost from birth. I've got to tell you, I found it astonishing. You may have seen it, but I found it astonishing to see boys, 5 and 6 years of age, kicking an empty plastic Coke bottle, if they didn't have a ball. And they bounced it. They bounced the Coke bottle on the ground and back up their hands like a proper pumped-up football. They just did it as that was a football. I stood there, boggle-eyed. Now, the AFL realises that just the incredible power that the shiny red Sharon footy has in Indigenous Australia. It's a power for good, or it can be. It's a magnet for kids in particular. So now if you're a footy-mad Indigenous primary school kid up in the Tiwi Islands, you can't be part of the AusKick program, which means you don't get to kick a football with the other kids, and you can't even play football in the competition unless you go to school. If you don't turn up at primary school, you don't play football. If you get kids to primary school, you get them in the habit of going to school, you're halfway there, half of the problem. On Melville Island, teachers told me they're now getting 80 to 85% attendance rates. And that's unheard of. These kids want to play football and they go to school. Let's stay at school for a moment, way down south from the Tiwi Islands, at West Penrith High School in Sydney's Outer West. I was there recently as part of that highly controversial 60 Minutes debate about changing the Australian flag. I won't go anywhere near that tonight, for fear of getting a few more threats from homicidal flag lovers. But I found that many of those year 10, 16-year-old boys and girls we spoke to, most of them from working-class homes, incidentally, they were happy to keep the flag the way it is, unfortunately. But what's most pertinent to tonight's topic was that every child in that class we spoke to in Western Sydney agreed that if the Australian flag was changed, then it must include recognition of Indigenous Australians. That was an amazing sentiment. I found it quite amazing, given that the kids came from about 15 different nationalities, and there's only one girl who was an Aboriginal girl. Yet they all agreed that any change in the flag must recognise the first Australians. Now you think, people here, it simply wouldn't have happened when we were kids, it wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. But young Australians have got the message. They've got the message. They're part of the healing process. Now I know these are only little things, but together they add up to a significant shift in Australia for the better as we walk together on this journey of healing. On a much broader front than footy and flags, there's a a revolution, I think, outside. As Bob Dylan said, get out of the way if you can't lend a hand, because the times, they're changing. Don't tell me that nothing positive is happening with Indigenous jobs in Australia, because it is. The Business Council of Australia represents a combined workforce of over 1 million workers. And last year, in its first annual report on its Indigenous program, the president of the BCA, Greg Galley, said that the failure to significantly improve the education prospects and provide jobs for Indigenous people is, quote, our greatest national shame. And he promised to do something about it. Joining with the federal government, BCA members, which include Australia's biggest companies, have now committed themselves to a range of Indigenous jobs and traineeships and mentoring schemes and cultural awareness programs in their workplace. Again, that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. Certainly wouldn't happen 20. And in tandem with this BCA pledge, the likes of which Australia's never seen before, is the Australian Employment Covenant, which promises to find 50,000 jobs for Indigenous Australians, and especially in the mining industry. The AEC is the brainchild of Andrew Twiggy Forrest, with the backing of the federal government, along with the public endorsement of other billionaires like James Packer and Kerry Stokes and the Lowy family and Lindsay Fox. So in essence, Australia's richest men, just think about this, Australia's richest men have made unqualified commitments of time and energy and money to help Australia's poorest people. Nothing like this has happened before in Australia. Andrew Forrest, who grew up with Aboriginal people in the WA Pilbara region, is on record as saying that he regards this 50,000 jobs commitment as more important to him than his lucrative iron ore business. We must take him at his word, because he's an honourable man. If the AEC ever comes close to achieving this jobs target, individual lives and communities across Australia will be improved beyond their wildest dreams. But something drastic has to be done, because the scale of the Indigenous job problem is scary. Over the next decade, 140,000 Indigenous young people will enter the working population. 140,000. These students are leaving school with low literacy and numeracy skills, lower levels of school achievement than non-Indigenous kids, and therefore poor prospects of finding a job. Now, there are two, and I'll finish shortly, there are two remarkable and innovative programs that are already making a significant mark on this problem. They're templates for what needs to be done right across Australia. One is about jobs and the other is about education. I want to finish tonight briefly by telling you about their achievements, their outstanding success stories, and I think they're a part of this healing process. 16 years ago, a prosperous cotton farmer up in the northern New South Wales town of Moree, named Dick Estens, started something called the Aboriginal Employment Strategy, the AES. It was doomed to fail in the eyes of the local know-alls. It was a bold initiative to give jobs and pride and self-esteem to local Aboriginal people. Moree, some of you here may know, Lowitja certainly does, was a sullen, angry place with a well-earned reputation for the Black Freedom Rides of the 1960s as the most racist town in Australia, Moree. Now, apart from giving young Aborigines a new life and a future with achievable dreams, Dick Estens thought that his AES, if it worked, might save Moree from wasting away like the other wild towns of western New South Wales, broken towns like Brawarrina and Bourke and Walgett. Administered almost entirely by Indigenous staff, a couple of white fellows, but almost entirely by 80-odd Indigenous people, the Aboriginal Employment Strategy has been a spectacular runaway success, spreading its jobs and school-based traineeship programs through every state, except, strangely enough, here in South Australia. And they tell me that's about to change. Roger, they tell me it's about to change. With the backing initially of only the ANZ Bank, but now with all the major banks and Australia Post and Woolworths and a host of our biggest employers, the AES will this year provide 1,550 full-time jobs to Indigenous workers and 500 traineeships to high school students. These students, many of whom come from families where nobody works, are all promised full-time employment, guaranteed, upon completion of their school traineeships, and there are 500 kids doing it around Australia at the moment. The Aboriginal Employment Strategy takes kids in year 11, as I mentioned, but Dick wants to rescue them a bit early. He thinks he wants to get them in year 7, 8 and 9, and some of the education experts will probably agree with that. Ironically, Dick Esten says that the biggest rival, get this, to his Aboriginal employment scheme in most towns and suburbs is Centrelink, the government-funded dole scheme. At the moment, Esten says, with understandable pride, that where he goes head-to-head with Centrelink, the AES has more black fellas on its book than the dole. And he's very proud, as he should be. The last element in our walk together on the journey of healing tonight is something called the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation, the AIEF. We've all got an AIEF. Up front, I have to declare a certain attachment to this foundation. I'm the voluntary unpaid chairman of the AIEF. Now, mind you, I had the same role in the Fred Hollows Foundation, where in a decade we fixed the cataract blindness of more than 1 million people, and we did it for free. So having an attachment to a good cause isn't necessarily a bad thing. There is no silver bullet when it comes to fixing Indigenous disadvantage. We all know that. Everyone in this room knows there's no silver bullet. If it was easy, governments would have done it years ago, so it's not easy. But in the words of our distinguished patron at the AIEF, Sir William Dean, he says to overcome the appalling problems of Indigenous disadvantage, education is the key. Education is the key, folks. You hear me? Education is the key. The Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, echoed similar sentiments in his maiden speech just over a year ago in Parliament. He said, If equality of opportunity does not begin in the school system, then it begins nowhere at all. The concept of giving 2,000 full-time scholarships at some of the best high schools in Australia to disadvantaged Indigenous boys and girls is an absolute no-brainer. It's a no-brainer. That's what the Indigenous Education Foundation is doing, which is why the federal government of Kevin Rudd has given us $20 million, which we have to match dollar for dollar with funds from corporates and families and philanthropic Australians. And we'll do it. We're already well on the way just after 1 year. By the end of this year, there'll be close to 200 Indigenous boys and girls on scholarships boarding at our partner schools in New South Wales and Queensland for the moment. We'll be here soon, don't worry. In the years ahead, the scheme will spread across Australia with a target of 2,000 full-time scholarships. Now imagine just for a moment, hundreds and maybe hundreds of young, well-educated, university-trained Indigenous leaders and role models in these communities. It's an educational initiative that has been successfully tested on a local level for almost a decade, most especially at St Joseph's Boys College in Hunters Hill in Sydney. There are 40 Aboriginal boys from a range of suburban and country homes now boarding at Joey's. 40 boys board there. And they've got the money now in perpetuity. They'll have 40 scholarships at that school. Over the last 5 years, out of 149 Indigenous boys and girls enrolled at the AIEF, at these partner schools, out of 149, 85% of them have completed Year 12. That's double the rate in the wider Indigenous school population. There are countless extraordinary stories of students who've already beaten the odds because of the opportunities provided to them by these scholarships. Our graduates so far include teachers and lawyers and doctors and bankers and accountants and tradesmen and one or two sporting stars. Let me just mention two of those awesome success stories. Craig Ashby was 16 and illiterate when he arrived at Joey's. He had to repeat year 9. He'd been raised in Walgett by his elderly grandmother. His life prospects were grim. He says it was jail and welfare. That's where he's heading. Well, today, a University of Sydney graduate, Craig, is about to embark next month on a career as a history high school teacher. He's already had lunch with the Pope. He was the official youth delegate chosen to meet Prince William, the heir to the British throne, early this year. And 7 years ago, he was on the streets in Walgett. Ricky McCourt is a kid from Nambucca Heads. That's a fishing town, if you didn't know, halfway between Sydney and Brisbane. His mother told Ricky that she didn't want him to go to the big school in Sydney. She didn't want him to go to St Joseph's when he won his scholarship. She said because she'd miss him too much. She's a good mother. But she said, if you don't go and get an education, then you're going to be ordinary like these other black kids in Nambucca Heads. And I don't want you to be ordinary. So he went, and his mum cried, and he cried, and The school gave him a mobile phone and he rang every time he felt like he had to need a bit of comfort from mum, and he moved on. Well, this year Ricky finishes his law degree at Bond University. He's anything but ordinary, with an outspoken ambition to be Australia's first Aboriginal Prime Minister. And nobody who knows Ricky McCourt would rule that prospect out. This kid is an amazing kid. And again, he could have been just ordinary on the streets of Nambucca. Let me finish our journey of healing with that story. It's an outstanding example, I think, of what can be achieved with a little help from your friends at school or the AFL footy players or Andrew Twiggy Forrest. I said a moment ago the problems facing Indigenous Australians are enormous. We all know that. That's true. Governments of all political persuasions, all of them well-intentioned, have failed to close this so-called gap of disadvantage. But there are real changes underway. One senses real progress and real reason to hope and to even dream. As Professor Fred Hollows used to say, and I think Don Dunstan would absolutely have agreed, the alternative is to do nothing. And that is simply not an alternative. Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so very much, Ray Martin, for your oration tonight. It has been a powerful oration that has truly lived up to the theme chosen, walking together on the journey of healing. By what you've spoken to us about, by examples, good, bad and ugly, you have deconstructed that sentence to all of its important meaning. You have acknowledged there has been a long walk and there continues to be an active walking that's needed. And you've acknowledged that this is something we do together. It is not for the other to deal with the problem. You've acknowledged it's a journey, and you've acknowledged that there is healing in this journey and that we then come together. You mentioned the reference that for many, this has been a journey of hurting. And you spoke about Jacob's comment, to live in the present, we must atone for the past. I think we all felt the challenge of such statements as their great regret. Their great regret because of how much history has gone past already, and yet the figures that you quoted in diabetes, for example, should still be the case. But you refuse to allow any of us, Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal Australian, to fall for the excuse, something uniquely intractable. The evidence so often can be circumstantial, but fundamentally wrong. The situation is not uniquely intractable, and you identified many powerful examples of how this is the case. When you talked about an 85% completion at year 12 at St. Joseph's, and mentioned that was twice the average for Aboriginal students, it's actually higher than the national average for anybody. When you spoke about the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation and Essen's AES program out of Moree, in each of those cases, they have taken on the intractable and refused to accept the narrative that that's the way things are. But your challenge, as I say, is to all of us. You said there is no room for excuses. There is no room for us to say, but that can be explained, because that then stops the option of genuine change and empowerment. So it has been a thorough oration that you've given us tonight, and in the thoroughness of it, you have truly helped us leave here challenged about where we are and where we go as a community, singly, collectively, and in our various levels of government and non-government activities. So Ray Martin, thank you so very much for your very powerful oration tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I now want to give to Ray as a thank you, a symbolic thank you on behalf of all of us, these music sticks. And I'm told that, Loetra, you can explain some of the dots on here that are much in the way that have some symbolism from the Bringing Them Home report. So that will be for you to take up later. Please join me in thanking Ray Martin. And I...